From WHQR Public Media in Wilmington, North Carolina, this is Coastline. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn. Joe Biden is now the clear frontrunner for the Democratic presidential nomination after Super Tuesday. Michael Bloomberg dropped out this morning and endorsed Biden, and North Carolina has proven to be an important state in this development. But the Cape Fear region is likely to have its own critical impact this election year. As The Hill reported last September, New Hanover County will be one of the key counties deciding the November election. But in North Carolina on March 3rd, voters also selected those candidates they want to see on the November ballot for county commissioner, board of education, state house and senate. They chose their council of state candidates, from auditor to commissioners of labor, agriculture, insurance. Representative Holly Grange, a Republican from New Hanover County, lost her bid for her party's gubernatorial nomination, while Dan Forrest goes on to face Democratic Governor Roy Cooper in the fall. We'll take a look today at the candidates for whom the 2020 election road has come to an end and unpack who now battles it out in November. Ben Schachtman, managing editor of Port City Daily, a frequent, nay, a regular contributor to Coastline, joins me now. Ben Schachtman, welcome back to the program.
Thank you for having me. I'm excited to be promoted to regular.
And we are, of course, inviting you to join the conversation. What surprised you about Tuesday's primary? Did you vote? Call us and tell us about what brought you to the polls or why you stayed home. You can call us during the live Wednesday discussion at 910-343-1138. If you'd rather email, you can do that at coastline@whqr.org. Ben Schachtman, let's talk the surprises first. What happened last night that you really weren't expecting?
So I was watching, I know a lot of people were watching the primary for the presidential candidate, but I really was focusing just on the local races. I think one of the things that definitely surprised me was the, let's talk about the New Hanover County Board of Commissioners. So two things that caught me off guard. One was how much cachet it carries for people who have recognition either from previous office or previous campaigns.
Recognition cachet.
Yeah, I think that, you know, we've often talked in the newsroom about whether or not, do those roadside signs really mean anything? And I think they probably do to a certain extent. And we've talked to some political science folks who say absolutely for undecided voters or for people who are, you know, just especially in something like this where they're not just voting a party line because you've got multiple, in a primary, you've got multiple Democrats to choose for or multiple Republicans to choose for. All of the winners you'll recognize from either 2018 campaigns or previous office in the county commission or, you know, Wilmington Council. So for the Democrat side, you've got Leslie Cohen, who ran for state office and won her primary in 2018 over Gary Shipman, and Kyle Horton, who ran against David Rouser, and, of course, Jonathan Barfield, who was a sitting county commissioner.
Did it surprise you that Jonathan Barfield came in third place out of three?
I expected, yes.
As the incumbent.
Honestly, yeah. It's something we see almost every time we break down the numbers in an election, is that an incumbent, especially an incumbent with who's popular with his base, sits right at the top. In this case, I mean, the numbers are close.
They are close. I mean, they're all 24% with fractions of percentage point differences.
But I did expect the field to be Barfield at the top, followed by some of the other candidates.
Yeah. And then on the Republican side, we have Skip Watkins, Bill Rivenbark, and Deb Hayes. Deb Hayes has actually run for a number of local offices, and I believe she served on the Planning Commission.
Yes, she was the chairwoman of the Wilmington Planning Commission. She's been on the commission for a long time. She's served in any number of boards. She's been a public figure in various ways, but hasn't won office. So she ran, I believe, in 2017 for Wilmington City Council. But if you're in the political scene in Wilmington, you know her name.
That's right. And Bill Rivenbark, of course, is midterm on New Hanover County's Board of Education. And when we were talking just before we started, you weren't sure how voters were going to feel about him going for a different office midterm.
Yeah.
And a couple of people have done that locally.
Yeah, and I think that this would apply to any candidate. I want to be clear, this would apply to any candidate. And some of the things we've seen in the past, we've seen candidates do what we kind of call a no-risk run. So you're in the middle of a four-year term, and you run for state office or you run for congressional or senatorial office. And if you win, obviously someone's going to fill your shoes locally, but that's probably your big chance, especially just looking at the expense of running a statewide or national campaign. You really probably only get one crack at it. So if the time's right, the time's right. Doesn't matter if you're in the middle at the end of a term. This was a little different because he's right in the middle of his term on the New Hanover County Board of Education, and that's been contentious, to say the least, for the whole board. It's been a tense situation for the board, and you know, Mr. Reifenbach's had a couple dust-ups with the media over the last couple months over everything from dealing with the county's bus driver situation to most recently during a press conference held about the status of now-fired former band director Peter Michael Frank, where he got into it with a WECT reporter, basically about, you know, whether or not the board was taking the right actions.
Yeah, and it's got to be tough for somebody who hasn't dealt with the media for a very long time or worked as a reporter. I mean, we know being on this side of it that sometimes dealing with public information officers or public figures who do have backgrounds in journalism, that they understand kind of that tension between the message that they're trying to get out to the public and what it's our job to do and what we actually have a right to in terms of information.
Absolutely. And I think one thing that not everyone understands from the outside, if you're a casual newsreader, is that almost all of our local politicians are so-called amateur politicians. They're part-timers. So that means they have to have a full-time life. They have to have a job. They don't have, you know, they're not like a congressman who that's their job. So for many of these people, especially if you're involved in a board that's going through something as, you know, difficult and as much upheaval as the Board of Education in New Hanover County is seeing, that's going to bleed over into your personal life and your job life. And I think that's, I mean, it's not often in the media you hear sympathy for these people, but to have to, you know, take a break from your private life and go and stand in front of, you know, a wall of cameras almost and face a firing squad of tough questions for your part-time job, I mean, that's tough.
It's got to be really frustrating, especially when you are read into an issue and sometimes you've got reporters who aren't. And there's always that tension between the information the public is demanding, not just reporters, but the people who are emailing you and calling you, you know, Joe citizens. There were so many issues that we talked about a couple of weeks ago about what might drive people to the polls this year and also what how those issues might affect some of these decisions. Yesterday, traveling around from precinct to precinct, I met someone who didn't want to be identified. Let's just call him Joe. And he voted, but he wasn't happy about it, and he didn't really want to talk to me about it. And I have some sound from him that's not very good because he kept asking me to turn off my recorder. And pretty soon, Hollis Briggs and Deborah Dix Maxwell, who are community leaders in Wilmington, joined us, and the discussion continued. One of the things that he said to me in our conversation was, there has never been an American president in my lifetime, he's 61 years old, who has done anything significant for the Black community. So I voted, but my vote doesn't really matter. And then after getting some affirmation from Hollis Briggs and Deborah Dix Maxwell that he could show me this, he showed me a slide on his cell phone that broke down how county contracts are awarded by race. And so we're going to listen to this. Hollis Briggs talks first, and then you'll hear Joe.
The disparity between the different races of people and how the county disperses their vendorship program. I'll just put it like that.
It's
bad. You understand? It's bad, and we don't see, the reason he's saying what he's saying is because we don't see anybody trying to fix it. You know what I mean?
See this? Mm-hmm.
Those doors right there, John.
This is what happened in 2018 in Hanover County. 79.25 million. Mm-hmm. 1.4 million went to women-owned businesses. Mm-hmm. Generally, that's white women. Mm-hmm. Black-owned businesses got $794,000 out of 79.25 million. Non-minority, $77 million. Keeping hope alive is one thing, but those numbers is another.
And that was the discussion with the guy we're going to call Joe, who I think, I don't know that he's tried to get contracts himself, but this is a really interesting part of the conversation. This very sad voter coming out of the polls and saying, yeah, I did my duty, but I don't really know if it has any meaning.
Sure. I think one of the things that we've heard, especially about the presidential election, but at all levels, of from the smallest local office all the way up to the president, is people feeling disenfranchised. Race is often a big part of it. Gender or sexual orientation is a part of it. Finance is a huge part of it. I mean, when you have, you know, when Bloomberg entered the race and, you know, make no mistake, just because he's out of the race, his money is still very much in the race. So he will, whoever he endorses, in this case Biden, will be the benefactor of that. He will help choose, you know, at least part of how the story plays out. But for people making $17,000 a year, watching two billionaires duke it out on the national stage has to feel a little disenfranchising.
That's right.
And then to bring it down to the local level, I mean, this is obviously a touchy subject, but we did talk to a lot of voters about this. And it goes for the city of Wilmington and the New Hanover County Board of Commissioners, but whether or not they feel sort of equitably represented. And it's not just about token representation. So just if you're a person of color and Jonathan Barfield's on the Board of Commissioners, that doesn't 100% mean you feel represented. So something to get into.
That's right. Yes. And they talked about the dearth of leadership they feel exists. You're listening to Coastline. Ben Schachtman of Port City Daily is with us today. We're looking at this year's primary election results, the issues on the minds of voters in 2020, and we want to hear from you. Did you vote on Tuesday? Why or why not? What was the issue or the candidate that created a fire in your belly? Call us during the live Wednesday discussion at 910-343-1138. You can email us at coastline@whqr.org. When we come back from this break, we'll hear some from some more folks who went to the polls. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn for Coastline. You're listening to Coastline. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn. Super Tuesday was a good day for Democratic presidential candidate Joe Biden, and North Carolina was a big part of his boost, but voters also chose candidates for county commissioner, board of education, state house and senate races, the candidates they want to see on the November ballot. Today we're looking at how November is shaping up with Port City Daily's managing editor Ben Schachtman. If you want to tell us why you voted or why you didn't this year, call us during the live Wednesday discussion at 910-343-1138. Or email us at coastline@whqr.org. Ben Schachtman, I think you just got a statement from one of the candidates for State House who was challenging incumbent Republican Representative Ted Davis Jr.
That is correct.
Do you have that readily available? And would you like to share?
I do. So this is from Justin Lanassa, who was challenging Davis. And he writes, quote, "After exposing all the unthinkable things Ted David voted for or championed into law, it is far and beyond my comprehension how 76 out of 100 people walking through that door to vote would willingly vote for such a shameful history. Until we have a elections department, that is more transparent, like being able to log into your account at the elections department and seeing how your vote is registered, you all will stay the lesser subjects that you are meant to be."
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Mr. Lanassa and Ben Schachtman. Yep. All right. Yeah, that was a contest that I'm not sure anyone is really surprised by the outcome of.
I will say one thing, though, for this contest, and that is that at least in local community groups that support gun rights, Ted Davis was very unpopular after actually putting forward some suggested gun control legislation. Mm-hmm. At one point, there was the NRA, the National Rifle Association, has a victory pack, and they have a website where they rank candidates. And at one point, they had actually taken this down, but at one point they had ranked Lanassa an A with an asterisk because he had no legislative record, but he had filled out a questionnaire indicating that he was emphatically pro-gun, and I think that's accurate. And Ted Davis, I believe, got a C or a C minus. And, you know, gun control is often considered to be, you know, a pretty divisive issue in national politics. And I expected it to be a little more divisive in the Republican Party for this race. And it didn't appear to play that much of a role.
Yeah, and Ted Davis has also racked up some serious seniority and is on a number of really impactful committees. And I think, I don't know if this is something that voters think about when they go to the polls or if it's just something that happens as kind of an insider calculation, you know, in within the parties. But the fact that somebody has developed relationships in Raleigh and knows how to get things done carries a lot of political capital. And of course, you know, we get those rankings with actually their power rankings in terms of who are the most powerful people in the House and the Senate at the state level.
Then, I would say, oh, go ahead.
No, please.
Well, I was just going to say, Davis, whether or not everyone's aware of it, Davis definitely ran on it. In every conversation I had with him and a lot of his other candidates, he leaned heavily on his ability to get stuff done. And I think it's fair to say, if you're an incumbent, and I asked him, and Lanassa both, for Davis, I asked, what are the pros and cons of being an incumbent? And for Lanassa, what are the pros and cons of being sort of a newcomer? And Davis said, look, the cons are I have to answer for the legislation I've done in the past and that I've had to work with Democrats in the past, which will make party hardliners not too happy with you. That's something he has to answer for at the polls. On the other hand, he does get to say, here's my track record, here's what I'll do, knowing that any freshman in Raleigh is going to spend a year just trying to take it all in.
Right. And now Ted Davis faces Democrat Adam Erickson in November. And he's a person that we all need to meet. Is this a person you've had a conversation with?
So we actually spoke with his campaign staff. I need to put this on the air. We apologize. We did have a typo where we said that Davis and Lanassa were the only candidates for District 20. We meant to say that they're only Republican candidates.
Right.
So our correction.
The primary race.
It was the primary. But we did reach out to his campaign. We're very much looking forward to talking to him and seeing, you know, what his sort of counter offer to what Davis has on the table will be.
And, you know, New Hanover County is such an interesting place in terms of the way the voters stack up, Democrat, Republican, and unaffiliated voters. And it's I think unaffiliated is the largest block at this point, but it still kind of shakes out to about a third, a third, and a third. And so partisan analysts and strategizers are always trying to figure out who is that unaffiliated one third. I ran into someone at the Halliburton Park precinct in Wilmington yesterday. This was her first time voting. She was 18 years old. And she was talking about how important it was to be an educated voter. And I have to say, this may not be fair, but I was really impressed for an 18-year-old at not only how committed she was to doing her civic duty, but how much she understood about the impact of it.
No, this is my first time voting.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
That's okay.
I'm 18, yeah, so I'm just first time, yeah. I think it's everybody's duty to vote. It's our civic duty to our city and to the country to vote for what we believe in. And I think it's important to share your voice. I've always seen my parents vote, and my mom used to work for the Board of Elections a while back. So she's been very adamant about voting and that whole process. So I was always just thought I needed to. So here I am.
And that was impressive to me that she knew about local races, because that, as you probably know in your travels around the region, it's unusual to find people who are well-versed in all of the local races.
Especially for the local races. I think, you know, I've said this on the air before, I was not the most educated voter my first time out. I've obviously gotten a little better at it. But it's hard, especially in news deserts across the country, to find really detailed information about local officials. And in our area, I'll say, you know, WECT did candidate interviews. You guys did great candidate interviews. We try to interview as many candidates as good for the primary. But if you were interested in what I call like the mid-level candidates, someone like a, you know, superintendent of instruction or state treasurer, it was hard to find good, unbiased, clear info. You knew plenty about the presidential candidates. You knew plenty about at least if you live in Wilmington, you're lucky you got a lot of good news resources. You knew plenty about the local, you know, Hanover County candidates, but in the middle, it was really tough. So I think you have to want it. You have to go out and track down that info. It's tough.
It is tough. And that's true. That's actually a question that a listener asked when we were doing a preview of the primary 2 weeks ago. She was asking, how do I even find this information? And we don't have a good answer, but we might have a good answer for you before the November election in 2020. You know, I mentioned in the introduction that The Hill reported last September that New Hanover County is going to be an important county in the presidential race. And the reasons for this, they point out, are dominated by Wilmington. The GOP's historic advantage is shrinking. Obama came within 1,400 votes of winning this county in 2008. And analysts say that Wilmington has seen an influx of urban white liberals, making the city more Democratic, while affluent retirees who tend to vote Republican are settling along the beaches. So what do you think that's going to mean for Wilmington and New Hanover County in terms of candidate visits over the next 7 to 8 months?
Well, I had just started in this region in 2016. And I will say, and Trump came twice. And
yeah.
Clinton sent Tim Kaine, and she did not come herself. And I think, you know, it's given how polarized things have been over the last 48 years or 20 years or 30 years, really. But given how things were so polarized at that moment, it seemed unlikely that Trump visiting would sway a white liberal progressive to vote for him. But Clinton not showing up might end up with that person sort of apathetically sitting it out. And so I think what it means for us is that we've got, as you pointed out, there's a third who are pretty consistently liberal Democrats, a third who are conservative Republicans, and a third that are in the middle. And I think there's two things going on. One will be a candidate that visits gets a chance to activate their base and not have them sit out an election because they feel disaffected. And also, there's a huge chunk of the population that is probably up for grads ideologically.
And yeah, that's the big open question. Are these people who just don't want to be identified as partisan leaners, or are they actually independent thinkers and independent voters who don't normally lean?
So I don't want to, you know, I don't want to paint with a broad brush, but I can say from our conversations with people at the polls and in general, you know, over the course of the last 4 years, there were conservative Republicans who voted for Trump for reasons that sat pretty well within the GOP party program. So reducing regulations in favor of expanding business, or, you know, renegotiating trade deals with foreign countries that they thought were inequitable, or, you know, getting the UN or NATO to pay more of the share of, you know, worldwide military operations. Whereas people who were in a more independent streak voted for Trump because they had been profoundly dissatisfied with the way Washington had operated. And I think it's fair to say there's been some dysfunction there for a long time. But it wasn't so much that they were voting because they particularly cared about, you know, finding a balance between the EPA and the chemical industry. It was more that they wanted to see anything else than the status quo. So that was kind of how those two things, and there was obviously some overlap, right? But that's how those two things looked to me.
You're listening to Coastline. It's primary 2020 results in North Carolina. The surprises, the November battles coming up, the head scratchers. With us on this exploration, Ben Schachtman. He's managing editor of Port City Daily. You can tell us how you see this year's election shaping up and whether you voted on March 3rd. Call us during the live Wednesday discussion at 910-343-1138. You can also email us at coastline@whqr.org. Mo writes, I would do anything to get Ted Davis out of office after he wanted to defund Planned Parenthood in Wilmington when he was a commissioner because, she writes, quote, women were not responsible if they were using birth control, end quote. Unaffiliated voter, writes Mo. However, living in Curie Beach, he is no longer my representative, and I am very excited to support Marsha Morgan in my precinct. And this is something that I don't know if voters are going to find confusing, but there were new maps drawn. The redistricting has pushed Ted Davis north. He is now in House District 20, and Marsha Morgan won her primary battle against James Dawkins for House District 19, which historically has been Ted Davis's district.
Yes.
And is the southern part of the county and also part of Brunswick County now.
Yeah, so this is a very interesting district, and representing this district is going to be tricky for whoever wins, because it covers coastal Brunswick County, it covers the southern part of New Hanover County. You've got some definite liberal Democrat enclaves, some stalwart, you know, conservative Republican, and just geographically, anyone will tell you, you know, those Brunswick beach towns are different than New Hanover County beach towns. They have different concerns. And it's one of the things we talked about in the newsroom is just the logistical challenge of covering that square mileage to get, you either have to take a ferry or drive all the way north and use the bridge and drive back down. But it's an interesting district with a lot of different concerns. So what I want to see how Morgan and Davis both say that they will address that, because you are representing the whole district, not just the people who voted for you. So how will they tackle that challenge?
Right. And it's interesting, too, because Marsha Morgan does present herself as more of a moderate than some of her other Democratic cohorts. And Ted Davis, as we've talked about, has been a little bit more moderate. I mean, you pointed out his rating by the NRA, which isn't good. And part of it is because of his position on gun legislation, which is something that probably, that's a cyclical issue in Raleigh. It comes around from to time.
Well, especially for Davis, some of the challenges will be, things that will come up again in the future, like funding, for example, for the film industry. That's something that primarily benefits Southeast and North Carolina.
And the western part of the state.
And the western part. But asking counties where there isn't a robust film industry to pay into that is a tough sell, and you're going to have to compromise somewhere else. Or the way the state in general handled the response to Gen X. Davis was on the outs with Raleigh leadership a couple times with that, because it is one thing to be in Raleigh and say, here's how we're going to do things. And it's much harder to be here at ground zero and to say to your constituents, well, we've decided to take a slow, measured approach to this. No, because people here wanted stuff done immediately. There are obviously times when the unique makeup and some of the unique industrial concerns, environmental concerns, economic concerns here don't match up neatly with one side of the aisle or the other side of the aisle in Raleigh. So they'll both have to tackle that. I think it's fascinating that we can say Marsha Morgan, who is a LGBT candidate, is the more moderate one.
Isn't that interesting? Yeah, that's a really good observation. Yeah.
I finally feel like we're in the 21st century.
But yes, and she credits her ability to talk with people in both parties with her military experience and her tour of duty in the Pentagon and on the Joint Chiefs.
Yeah, absolutely. The story she always told me was about a situation where she had to work with an African-American gentleman. So there was the situation was fraught, race, gender, just the stress of the job. They butted heads, ultimately ended up being a good team. And she ultimately, helped him get promoted. But that's a really unique situation where you don't have the option to just sit on your side of the aisle and do what you want. You have to. So I'm not saying mandatory military service, but mandatory military service or kitchen duty, I think is helpful.
The top presidential candidates statewide, of course, turned out to be Trump and Biden. County by county, in the Cape Fear region anyway, it was the same story. Trump and Biden were the top vote getters. At the Halliburton Park precinct yesterday, I also met a Republican hanging out with a group of Democrats. There were a couple of Krispy Kreme boxes of donuts. They were all electioneering, but talking and seemingly having a good time. The precinct chair of W16 took some time to talk with me about her journey into party activism.
It is just so important to find out more about what's going on and vote. I was not educated about what's going on for a really long time, but it's pretty easy. I have a young kid. I work full-time. After Trump won, I was pretty upset. People in the office were crying. it was that bad. And so that's why I got involved, because, I could be one of those five votes that makes a difference.
That was Audrey Penny's precinct chair, W16 in New Hanover County, for the Democratic Party. But this is the funny thing about North Carolina. The passion on both sides is something that can be hard to understand. Looking at the U.S. Senate race, for instance, Tom Tillis's seat, he's finishing his first term, faced three Republican challengers, won handily. He'll face Democrat Cal Cunningham. This race is called a Republican lean by the Cook Political Report, meaning there's some contest there because that's weaker, worse for Republicans than likely, but it is better than a toss-up. Do you think maybe the tide will turn a little bit this year and North Carolina will be less red?
I think, like I said, I feel my travels throughout North Carolina that we're not alone with having a large independent sort of body or unaffiliated body of voters. I saw the same thing in Asheville. I get the same vibe in Durham. And I think there's always going to be an anti-establishment vote or an anti-status quo vote that Trump played into handily. Like I said, a lot of it had to do with support from, you know, trusted Republican people who voted Republican all their life. But there were us also, I mean, even people who might have considered themselves Democrats 20 years ago might have considered an anti-status quo candidate. So I think that's up for grabs every 4 years because it's what's true for Davis is true for Trump. Being an incumbent gives you a lot of advantages, but you have to answer for what's happened over the last 4 years. So by the time we get to the general election, we will have had, you know, nearly 4 years of, you know, economic data. We'll have whatever the ultimate response to COVID-19 is. We'll have the state of trade deals, and people will be able to hold that either in Trump's favor or against him, whereas a newcomer candidate, even if they've held congressional or Senate office, will still say, I would do a better job, and you will have to say, maybe you will, maybe you won't.
You're listening to Coastline. It's Primary 2020, the results with Port City Daily's Ben Schachman. Tell us what's on your mind this election year and whether you voted in the primary, what you want to see in November. You can call us during the live discussion on Wednesday at 910-343-1138 or email us at coastline@whqr.org. After the break, it's the last segment, so just a few minutes left to get your comment in. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn for Coastline. You're listening to Coastline. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn. It's a look at the 2020 primary results in North Carolina with Port City Daily's managing editor, Ben Schachman. And we want to hear from you on this post-election Wednesday. How did you view the primary? Did you vote? Why or why not? What was the candidate or the issue that lit the fire in your belly? Did you have one? You can call us during the live Wednesday discussion at 910-343-1138. You can also email us at coastline@whqr.org. It is the last segment, so just a few minutes left to get your question or comment in. And we do need to take a look at Brunswick County. There weren't a lot of local races in the county, but there were a couple. Brunswick County Commissioner Pat Sykes, who has been the incumbent, soundly trounced her challenger, a city councilman from Oak Island, Jeff Weinkoff. And this was also one of those cases, Ben, where somebody who was recently elected, in his case, he's not even halfway into his term. He was just elected to the Oak Island Town Council last November and decided after a series of personal tragedies that he wanted to jump to the county commission level. And that didn't go well for him. But there was also the Brunswick County Board of Education race. And Stephen Barger looks like he picked up the Republican nomination.
And he may very likely win the whole kit and caboodle. I believe it's Barger. I don't think there's a Democratic candidate filed. So unless someone mounts, and it's possible, we've seen it in the past.
Yeah.
Someone would have to mount a pretty impressive write-in campaign. Otherwise, he is sort of the, you know, de facto winner. So he will most likely end up on that board, is my guess.
And it's interesting, too, because he pretty soundly defeated. He had two other challengers, Shirley Babson and Ellen Milligan. Shirley Babson is someone who was on the Brunswick County Board of Education for many, many years. I mean, she was one of those legacy Board of Education members. And it's just interesting that she did come in second, but trailed far behind Stephen Barger. Also interesting, David Robinson, in a different district in Brunswick County's Board of Education, District 2, beat out Catherine Cook.
This is a very, very close race, though. It's actually close enough that it could, if requested, trigger a recount. So there's some tricky math. You have to add up all the ballots, and 1% of that becomes the margin. So in this case, the margin's around, I believe, 140 votes, and they're under that. We haven't heard back from Catherine Cook yet today. We don't know if she will request one. Sometimes it's worth waiting for absentee ballots and the recount, the canvas, rather, which will be in a week and a half.
Talking about the Board of Education, we should also talk about New Hanover County. Was this a surprise for you? Because we were looking basically at four candidates on the Republican side. And as we know, New Hanover County's Board of Education has been under fire, specifically for their handling of allegations of child abuse by staff and their apparent lack of transparency in terms of how they're dealing with this. And you have also done some investigative reporting and on your own pointed out that they have had a practice in the past of transferring problematic employees to other districts where those people can go on to abuse other children. So under that kind of fire, we were looking at another legacy candidate, Janice Kavanaugh, who was running. She had served on the New Hanover County Board of Education for decades, and she came in third place, so she'll be on the ballot.
She'll be on the ballot. I was surprised to see her come back after I believe she lost in the 2018 election. And we were surprised because she had been on the board so long, and many of the current board members have defended themselves from accusation of systemic problems by saying that they are newcomers. So at least three of the current board members have repeatedly said that in press conferences and in interviews with me. Kavanaugh is actually named in a number of articles we've done that dated back to the early 2000s or even the 90s. There was one former teacher and parent in particular who wrote to the board members and the administration at the time, this was the late 90s, early 2000s, about Michael Earl Kelly and another former New Hanover County teacher named Richard Preode. And Kavanaugh was one of those people who was contacted by this parent. And so it would be difficult for her to mount the same kind of defense, saying, like, I wasn't there, I didn't know, this is all new to me. We were surprised that she would throw her hat back in the ring. But again, I think there is, some people just recognize the name.
That happens.
That does happen. I will say, we asked her, as we asked all the candidates, let's get right to it. Let's talk about the issues. And she had very little to say. She said basically that the school had addressed the issue by creating the Ethics 360. That's New Hanover County's school district's new online complaint system. And that there needed to be a zero tolerance policy. But the other candidates we spoke to went on at great length, paragraphs and paragraphs, and spent the bulk of their time talking about this as the main concern. And she, didn't weigh in that heavily, which struck us as odd. So, well, again, we have to wait till the general election to see how that shakes out when it's, three on three.
And I do have to make a correction here. I referred to the Brunswick County Board of Education Republican top vote getter as Barger. And I am told he is actually Barger.
Grr.
So there it is. Sorry about that, Stephen Barger. Another interesting race this November, North Carolina Senate District 9. Democrat Harper Peterson is the incumbent. He beat out the person who is going to be his challenger again this year, Republican Michael Lee. It's a rematch of 2018.
It truly, and it was close. I mean, we both remember there was quite a bit of speculation about whether or not there would be a request for an official recount. But it really came down to a really small number of votes. It could have gone either way. And it will be interesting to see, you know, whether the issues are the same, because we really haven't put a lot of those issues to bed. Film is still an issue. We've seen, luckily for the people in this region, we've seen more pilots filmed in the area. But the way the law is still set up, there's always going to be that axe hanging over their head. We still haven't come, I think, for most people, if you ask them, are you satisfied with the state's reaction and treatment of Gen X? I think most people would still say no on either side of the aisle. So I think that's still very much in play. And I wonder if...
And it's funny that at the state level, that became a partisan issue. And I think that's, you know, perhaps you could argue that it's a partisan issue at the federal level as well, with the Trump administration's approach to EPA regulation of some of these chemical compounds. But certainly at the local level, I don't think you can say it's been partisan.
The two are intertwined. So one, whatever happens at the EPA is, you know, that's at the federal level. And the move has been to deregulate. To the EPA has taken steps to start looking more seriously at Gen X and other PFAS, but there's still no federal regulations for it.
And this is something that we've been hearing almost since the news broke in 2017.
Yes.
Now, and we keep getting these deadlines. Oh, around the fall, we'll hear something about a recommendation or a standard, and the fall comes and goes, and it doesn't happen.
Right, and that's crucial in North Carolina because the Hardison Amendment, which essentially says that the state's environmental agency can't go beyond what the feds have done unless the governor declares sort of a state of emergency. And there's, you know, 4,000 different PFAS chemicals, so that at a certain point becomes logistically unwieldy. So the DEQ, which is, you know, the Department of Environmental Quality at the state level, is kind of, you know, handcuffed a little bit. And to the extent that it was a partisan issue, it had to do with, I don't want to say the private market because it's not exactly right, but the conservatory system, which was sort of letting, you know, admittedly brilliant scientific minds handle the issue. Or sending funding to the DEQ. The problem was that the university system has no enforcement.
Right. The DEQ is the enforcement arm of the state.
Yes. And so it had a lot to do with, and we asked all of our local representatives this question, you know, do you think the DEQ is underfunded? Have they been undercut? Have they essentially been sabotaged by not getting the funding they need to do the job they need to do, to have everything from, you know, just employees to equipment to, you know, lawyers, obviously a big part of what's going on right now. And a lot of the people on the Republican side said, no, DEQ's been mismanaged. They have what they need. We prefer to go with the conservatory system. And a lot of the more liberal or Democratic people we asked said, no, the DEQ's absolutely been underfunded. They need more money. So it's sort of been a political football in Raleigh. And we're sort of the unfortunate loser in that game, in the matter, because we're just still waiting for, you know, results, basically.
You're listening to Coastline. It's primary 2020 results from North Carolina. The surprises, the November battles. With us on this exploration, Ben Schachtman. He's managing editor of Port City Daily. You have a couple of minutes left to tell us how you see this year's elections. If you voted, if you did or didn't, tell us why or why not. Call us during the live Wednesday discussion at 910-343-1138 or email us at coastline@whqr.org. Joby Sprinkles in the house. That's always good news. When we look at, he's our engineer from Charlotte. When we look at some of the state House and Senate races, Deb Butler, who did not have a primary battle, will now face Republican challenger Warren Kennedy. And these are, for some of us, kind of unknown candidates that we're going to have to get to know. In North Carolina, House District 17, longtime Republican Representative Frank Eiler of Brunswick County is going to be battling Democrat Tom Simmons, who I believe this is not Tom Simmons' first rodeo in the challenge battle. He's done this before.
I think this is actually a rematch.
Yes.
From 2018.
Yes.
So I'll be interested to see, you know, if either of them have sort of changed their approach to things.
I mean, does he have a shot? Tom Simmons, the challenger, because we're talking about, and, you know, talking to a Democratic Party person yesterday in Brunswick County, I was saying, this is such a red county. What's your strategy? I mean, how do you develop a strategy in a red county?
Go ahead.
But well, I think he was saying it's not so red.
It's, but, I think it depends on which angles you focus. I mean, there are certain issues that you will always probably see go more red in Brunswick County. But yeah, I think you could make environmental arguments. I think you could make economic arguments. I mean, Brunswick County is growing incredibly fast. So one of the things they need is infrastructure. Because county can't build roads, a lot of that comes from the state level. So I think there are, first of all, there are nonpartisan issues that you could hammer on. But there are also, you know, every day, you know, if you live in Brunswick County, every day there are more people moving to the region from the Midwest and from the Northeast. And a lot of those people, even if they identify as conservative, New York conservative is North Carolina liberal. So I think as the population dynamics change in Brunswick County, as people continue to move there, not only does the red-blue balance shift, but also what it means to be a Republican in Brunswick County shifts a little bit too.
And on that note, North Carolina Senate District 8, also a longtime seat held by Republican Bill Rabin, he is going to face another challenge from Democrat David Sink in November. And I think this is also a rematch. So we'll just see how that goes. But we should note that Bill Rabin has, for a long time now, been considered one of the most powerful Republicans in Raleigh.
Yeah, and I think that's a large part of his, in my conversations with him in the past, a large part of his platform is essentially that he was, I believe he was on the Department of Transportation Appropriations Committee, but he can move the ball quite a bit in Raleigh compared to a freshman senator.
That's right. And we should note that Representative Holly Grange, Republican representative from New Hanover County, threw her hat in the primary ring for the Republican gubernatorial nomination, and she lost in every single county to Republican Dan Forrest. And I think that her throwing her hat in the ring in that race was something of a surprise to GOP insiders. And it made me wonder if that was one of the big reasons for her loss.
We saw some early polling that showed it was going to be unbelievably difficult. And often, you know, the parties, both parties, the GOP and the Democratic Party, want to conserve the resources. Even when they have talented people, they will often encourage them to seek maybe a more realistic office. That seemed like a big jump. Yeah. But, you know, at the end of the day, it's up to the candidate whether or not they want to take that dash. But I think, you know, that was a tough hill to climb, let me put it that way.
North Carolina's 7th Congressional District, the seat that Republican Representative David Rauser has held for three terms now. He will face Democrat Christopher Ward in November. However, this is one of those seats that is widely called a Republican safe seat by pundits and analysts. This is not one anyone is going to be watching very closely.
I would not stay up late for this one. Rauser has won by considerable margins over a number of challenges over the last couple of years. He is, and he has a similar track record, you know, when you're talking about Davis or Rabin. He's been very effective at getting legislation for beach renourishment, which has made him very popular in the beach towns. And no one has apparently found a good political wedge to sort of drive in there. So, yeah, unless something radically changed in the next 3 months, I would say you could probably sleep on that race.
Yeah. And when we talked a couple of weeks ago, we talked about the potential sale of New Hanover Regional Medical Center as one of the factors that could be a driving force in what happens in 2020 elections. Did we see any evidence of that in any way, or is that just hard to read right now?
So I would go out on a limb and say there's definitely a role. The top two vote getters, Leslie Cohen and Kyle Horton, explicitly ran on not selling the hospital. To say that didn't play even a little role would be kind of crazy.
And that's this edition of Coastline. Ben Shockman of Port City Daily, thanks so much for joining us today.
My pleasure.
Hope you'll have a chance to get some sleep later this week.
Let's hope.
Coastline's production team is led by Rachel Keith and includes Ken Campbell, Marissa Castrino, and Doc Jardin. If you missed part of this episode, look for it at whqr.org, on the app, or get the podcast. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn for Coastline.